This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
This week on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7, COVID-19, a CBU senior health instructor talks with us about the pandemic. And even though he may not be boasting about it, musician and singer Donnie Campbell is a Canadian folk icon. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The pandemic COVID-19 virus is on everyone's minds these days as governments throughout the world struggle with it and people are inundated with information about the virus and how to keep it from spreading. Dialogue's own Paul McDougall, the host of The Good Sentence, just so happens to be a senior instructor in the Health Sciences Department at Cape Breton University. He's a registered microbiologist with the Canadian College of Microbiologists and a certified medical laboratory technologist in microbiology with the Canadian Society of Medical Laboratory Scientists and has worked for a number of years as a clinical microbiology technologist. He spoke with Bill McCush.
Before the coronavirus outbreak, what kind of work did you focus on that prepares you and your colleagues to better explain COVID-19 to the general public?
Well, a lot of program is we teach courses, because we teach public health at CBU, we teach courses in epidemiology, we teach intro microbiology, we teach courses that deal with often it's more of the practical day-to-day things, right? You know, like water contamination, food contamination, things like that. Things that can be, in many ways, can be controlled. Like a contaminated water supply with bacteria can be pretty serious, but over the past 100 years, we've learned many ways to deal with those kinds of things. You know, you chlorinate your water, you filter your water, all these kind of things. And we teach students the various testing methods for food, what pathogens can be in food, how do you deal with them, how do you have food recalls, because a lot of our students would become public health inspectors. So now viruses, you touch on a little bit there, but one of the issues is that it's the uncertain nature of viruses. I teach one class that's called Environmental Issues in Public Health, and I teach a whole lecture on that, how viruses can spring up, they can pop up, and they can be very devastating. And there's not a lot you can do to truly predict when something can happen. Now, virologists that are experts in the field can speak to this and say things can happen and they can mutate and change and we will see a problem organism. And it does happen. It's like the thing, the uncertainty of it is when and where and how bad. So it's hard to teach prevention of things like that in just day-to-day lecturing and teaching, right? But when something like what is happening here now is happening, what you have to do is everybody has to start to begin to follow the lead of the experts in the field, and I think that's going on here in the province now. And you have to follow what the Department of Health says, and they take their guidance as well from combing through all the literature from all the experts, everybody they can get. So there's a great deal of mobilization happens, and that's what has to be done. But viruses are insidious. They're a problem. We've had them for a long time. They don't go away. And in general, we live and breathe and we come in contact with them. And that's why part of public health, modern public health these days, is to teach people to try to stay healthy by exercising, eating the proper amounts of food, the right kind of food, all that, just so your body, when it comes in contact with something, especially if it's something new, that's why they call this corona the novel coronavirus, you know, the new one. It wasn't known of before, you know, like mainly November of last year when it happened in China. So you got to, that's kind of what you can do to discuss virology in kind of a general sense before something actually happens. And when it does happen, the severity of it dictates what you can actually do about it.
In your experience, how does this virus compare to others in the past?
Well, so if we just go back, like say a short span of time, like kind of my career in the world of microbiology. So for at least about the past 20 years, there has always been the worry of the of a flu virus, an influenza virus, and this. Different types of influenza, but there's two main groups, influenza A and influenza B. Influenza is the more common one in humans, but for at least 20 years, the World Health Organization was worrying that there would be a pandemic influenza that could be as bad as the one of 1918-19 that killed 20 million people. So there was a lot of preparation in developing a vaccine ahead of time for what could potentially be the one that causes the most problems. So that organism ended up being nowhere near the threat that it was. It was the one from 2009, and its code name was H1N1. It only killed about 12,000 people worldwide, part of it was there was a vaccine. So that was the year. Remember, everybody was getting the two vaccines, the regular flu vaccine, and then the one for H1N1. Part of why it didn't happen also was that virus itself wasn't as lethal, and it didn't spread as quickly and as much as was projected. So now, basically, you know, 10 years later, we have a different one. It's not flu. It's this corona. And these coronaviruses also have been around for a number of years. And some of the colds we get are often caused by a coronavirus or a rhinovirus. There's different types of viruses. We get colds and we get over them. There's never been vaccines developed for them because they've been difficult to do and many different things cause colds. So it's hard to pinpoint which one it is or which one it isn't. But now in the last number of years, we had the, in 2003-04, SARS, which was a type of coronavirus. SARS got headed off and stopped because of the really quick response of public health teams to the temperature spike happened quickly, so people could be caught out with a high temperature, and then they were isolated, right? And also the virus, that type of coronavirus did not take hold as easily in the body as this present one, from what evidence seems to suggest. So that SARS one then had to go deep into the lungs rather quickly to take hold. So our own body's defenses were able to fight that off, and only people that were, you know, seriously had underlying issues and that fell victim to that. And the spread of the SARS virus back then was most infectious at the same period as people had the serious symptoms, and the symptoms, as far as the sudden acute, the symptoms came on quickly. So we were able to public health people. When I say we, that's the general wide-scale scientific medical community was able to pinpoint all those people, get them isolated, get their contacts isolated, and they broke the back of it. And that particular virus, as far as I understand, that particular type of virus, that has not come back. A few years ago, another coronavirus popped up in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia. It's called Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. That's been circulating for a few years, but it has never caught on. It has never taken off. Like what's happening now. So this is like the third serious coronavirus in the class coronavirus. This one seems to have this longer incubation period. That means it can be in the body. You may or may not develop symptoms. If you do develop symptoms, it may take a few days. But unfortunately, it appears to be while you're carrying it, while you have it, and you don't even know you have it, you could be spreading it. And so... That's when I say the insidious nature of some of these viruses. That's a big problem with this one. People have it, could have it, may have it, don't know you have it, and then you spread it, and then it's really serious, especially for a susceptible population. And this an interesting aspect of the whole thing is that so many research people and scientists worldwide and epidemiologists and medical community are trying to do something about this. And there's numerous papers have come out on it. There's what we call cohort studies. There's a big one out of China that was published just last week, and which is trying to explain when you see who got ill and who passed away from it, unfortunately, what were their own underlying conditions and stuff like that. So we start to see evidence like high blood pressure or hypertension that happened in 200 of the first deaths studied in China. Hypertension was in 30% of them, so 90% of them had diabetes and 8 or 9% had some kind of coronary disease. So it's become quite evident who is the most risk, and the elderly, and elderly meaning basically over 70 range, okay, but even 60 is at risk. Everybody is at risk, but the people that succumb the most had these kind of underlying symptoms, or they call it a comorbidity, another illness at the same time. So what we know is who's at most risk, and that's the whole deal with what's going on now with trying to isolate people, cut down all social interactions, all meetings, gathering groups, all that, is if we can do this for a while, maybe we can salvage and not have the people that are most highly at risk come in contact with the virus. So this is, I don't know if virologists that can speak much better to this would have been predicting that something of this nature was going to happen. But when you look back to the flu, there was all of the worry about influenza and the flu. And now it's a different virus. And this is causing the problem that people worried about 9 years ago, unfortunately.
Can you talk about how long the virus can remain active on a surface at work or at home, and how effective are masks and gloves?
Okay, there's been some, there's been actual studies where they've, and this is recent news, perhaps by air dated, it'll be more out there, but what they're seeing is they've done studies where they create a little device which mimics basically a sneeze or a cough. Virus particles are put into this thing, in a lab setting, all controlled, and then they shoot it out and they mimic that onto surfaces. So they're seeing that this virus can last anywhere from hours to potentially a couple of days on surfaces. So this is what I'm reading and seeing in the literature. And now one thing to know is let's say you can detect it up to two, some are saying possibly up to 3 days, but you also things to be cautious about all that is so it's not like getting people into widespread panic and everything about, like, everything, but there could be some virus left, but not all of it. So a lot of it is that the half-time or the half-life is a matter of hours. So that means how long does it take for half of the viral load to hit the surface to go? And in many of those, that's a short period of time. And then the half-life would happen again, and you get rid of half more. So even though the virus appears to be lasting on surfaces, how much of it and all that, it's less than what was there in the beginning. But this is what the thing is about surfaces and cleaning is, so, you know, if someone was there, if somebody had been coughing or sneezing that has the virus, or any virus, a cold virus, anything like that, a flu virus, it can land on surfaces, and it can last for a while. So, but this has kind of been known, but this one, it appears to be, there's lots of work and studies being done on it to show that it does, so that we have to be more vigilant around, you know, those that are ill, and try to, you know, avoid surfaces and things, and then avoid getting your hand into your face, right? So that's one of the things. The other things with the social distancing is really just so for the, and this is a hard thing for people to do because we are social, right? So this is very difficult. So that's going to take an emotional toil on people, and it's this mental aspects to it all. That's all hard, but the idea is, if we're not passing any kind of respiratory droplets back and forth within, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 meters, you see different things about it. But if someone is sick or ill or coughing or sneezing or whatever, we just want to keep the distance from them. And because we're not so sure if someone is a carrier or not, that's why they're talking about, you know, if you're with one person or two or three people, okay, and somebody had the corona, well, that could spread. Or maybe, what are the odds are the two or three have it? Probably not so high. But if you're out in a place with 100 people in a small crowded hall playing cards, you know, then maybe you have 5 or 10 people that are the carriers of it. So that's why they started out, what, groups, you know, lessening the numbers all the way down. But the bigger risk is more people gather together, so that's going to increase the odds that someone could have it, and then you could spread it to many. So that's why we've got to, people have to pay attention. Like, there were still people, like, as of Friday and Saturday, there were still clubs going on, and just, you can't take, like, anything under 150 is okay, or 50 is okay, or whatever. You gotta be practical about it. If it isn't urgent situation where you have to have people together, just stay away for a while. We've gotta kind of break the back of this thing, or flatten the curve, as they say, of it, trying to have less cases happening all at once, so the hospitals don't get overcrowded and everything like that. That's what we have to do. You have to listen to public health. Don't poop hot, and people are going to have to hunker down for a while. Because, you know, first off, when everything closed and shut down, there's almost nothing left. There's nowhere to be going anyway, right? So that's a thing. We got to put faith in the science and the medical community, and there's also hope that this will work. And the thing is, some people say, well, what's the bother? Why are we bothering doing this? It may not work anyway. Well, you don't want to may not work. You want to do what you think the advice of the experts in the, you know, the scientists, epidemiologists, virologists, public health people, they spent their lives working on this kind of stuff. So you have to take their advice and say, when this gets stopped and we're all better of it, we're going to say, God, I'm glad we followed these procedures that the authorities told us to do, that people that knew what they were talking about told us what they do, right? If there was a slight chance something didn't work out and it got worse, then you're going to say, oh, well, we didn't do anything anyway, so we let it get worse. No, we have to do what, you know, I think the premier, I think Dr. Strang, for our province, they're standing tall on this. They're trying to do the best that we can do, and this updates constantly about it. And we just got to take it serious, and also don't let it get to you. I mean, keep a sense of humor. People on the internet that post funny things that make you laugh, those people are doing a good service too, right? You know, they really are. There was two the other day I saw. They're in the aisle of a grocery store with life preservers over the neck, and they were playing the violin, and the aisle was empty of the toilet paper, and they were playing on fiddles, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." So, you know, I got more out of that yesterday when I saw that, and I thought, yeah, okay, someone's got a sense of humor about it, because take it serious, but, like, try to remain calm about it all, too.
Like you said, Paul, it seems it would be helpful for people to deal with the reality of the pandemic, but there are some signs of improvement and pockets of optimism out there. So if someone who is a microbiologist sees it that way, then the public should have trust in that and stay positive to some degree.
Yes, that's definitely true. You've got to look and search those things out, because I've been reading some things about where people are saying, yeah, there are ways to, you know, to deal with this. If you're going to be in, and we're not in a lockdown thing, but we're in a situation where it's basically there's nowhere to go, so you should be staying home. But, you know, there are things you got to start thinking about. Okay, what am I going to do if, let's say we are told everyone is going to stay in for 2 weeks or whatever, okay? So lots of people have the internet. Now, I know some don't, but if you do, right, and you know how to play chess, well, join one of those online chess clubs and, you know, maybe play chess with somebody in Italy, right? You don't need language to play chess, okay? It's a universal game. You can probably find checkers on there. You can, read some of the books that have been stacked up on your stairway that you've gotten for the past 5 Christmases and haven't gotten to yet. I would guess that online subscriptions to movie streaming services are probably going to start going through the roof. I haven't watched Breaking Bad yet, so there's 60 nights if I watch one a night for me. My son says it's the best show ever. He says, how could you wait? I said, well, I was waiting for a good time. So I mean, there's things like that, you know, and if you're going to be in at home or spending at least more time in, you know, I don't know, break out those old jigsaw puzzles, right? Things like that. And do things that will take your mind off of, you know, the kind of constant barrage that we're going to be hearing about, right? So just try to find things like that to do. I mean, I think those are going to be helpful, but pay strict attention when you see, like, the provinces doing a news release or an update, or Dr. Strang is, or the Deputy Minister of Health, or the CBRM, whatever. Pay attention to those things, follow along, do them, and don't take it not seriously, the illness, because it is serious, and its effects are more vulnerable population, but also try to just keep a stiff upper lip. When you can laugh about things, do it. I don't know, make up jokes and post them to Twitter. There's a good thing to do.
You mentioned earlier researchers, maybe some of the brightest people in the world, are working around the clock to find a vaccine now. And what can you tell us about the vaccine testing taking place now? And what about the people who volunteer very bravely to have it administered to them?
Yeah, what I understand now, there are a number of different companies or government labs or agencies. A lot of people are working on the vaccine. I understand there's an Australian group that is getting pretty close to getting something. There's another group that has one that they've actually, some people have been injected with the vaccine already. So the issue with vaccines, let's say you get a vaccine, you think it's a possibility, then you definitely have to test it on some people for side effects, right? And there are people. There's always people that will come forward to do things like this, and they're brave people, and they'll work under the severest conditions or hazards. You know, not unlike a fire person going into a burning building, right? There's always going to be people that are going to help. Now, with the vaccine, if you get a vaccine, the vaccine shows promise, then it's going to have to be tested. Okay, so you have no side effects. Then. Normally, things like this, you have to do controlled studies in that. But, you know, what are you going to do in a case like this? It's not going to be, we'll test some people and not other people or whatever. I think what will happen, if they get a vaccine and people can tolerate the vaccine and they think it's effective, what I would think is they will probably roll this out. But this is months away. And what, in my mind, what I'm thinking is the vaccine is, we're getting this vaccine ready for, if we can break the back of this thing now in the next few weeks or months or whatever, if it comes along again, we'll be ready with it. Now, so it's still a ways away, and some of the experts were talking 12 months, 18 months. Others now, those numbers seem to be dropping. But I'll tell you one kind of encouraging thing, like in the world of vaccines. In the last couple of years in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, they've had Ebola. Now, that's a hemorrhagic virus. It's terrible, 80% death rate. But they worked on that literally night and day for months. They got a vaccine. The vaccine was working, and they rolled out the vaccine to literally the entire, all the contacts. It's called ring vaccination. They find an index case, first person who, or in an area that has it. Then they contact every contact of that person, so a ring around them, and then a secondary ring, the contact of the contacts, and they gave that vaccine to all those people. And it was just last 2 weeks ago or less, they announced that the last case of Ebola that was in the certain provinces in the DRC it was gone. There was no new cases. So that vaccine, various agencies have said, was like 99% effective or something. So our effectiveness, the science behind it, the technology of getting vaccines is light years ahead of what it was before. So I feel good about that, the fact that we know how to make vaccines. Now, respiratory ones are different, so they could be, and they can change. So, but it's like, you know, when we use the flu vaccine every year, and it's effective, but it's certainly not 100% effective. But even that vaccine can lessen, from what I understand, the effects of the flu. You could get the flu, but if you had the vaccine, you're much better off by having the vaccine, because you're, what you had of the flu was probably much lesser, the symptoms, than it would have been without it. So you got to put faith in that. There's also drugs. I understand there's a couple of antiviral drugs that are in the works. One of them, remarkably, is I've been noticing uses quinine, which, you know, like 100 years ago was an anti-malaria drug, which is caused by a parasite, not a virus. So there's work on the antiviral drugs also. So it's like the whole world community, as far as I can tell, the scientific community, the microbiology community, the medical community is mobilized, and people are trying to figure out what to do about this. So the role of the everyday person really is to just follow the rules that the public health agencies and the governments are telling you, and weather out the course, right? Listen to some good music. Listen to the coast. Listen to Coast Radio. Yeah,
that's right, Paul. Exactly. Another important point, governments and community leaders are stressing that social distancing will take some time to be effective, or at least to see the results of it. Can you explain that concept and why it makes sense to stay hopeful and enjoy yourselves in the meantime, if I can put it that way, while being vigilant and aware of what's happening in the world?
Yeah, well, with the, you know, you can... critics could say, oh, we should have done this 2 months ago or 3 months ago. But there's, you know, it's very hard to predict all and everything that was going to happen. And one of the things is, because of the nature of it, because it seems to spread so very quickly, and then you have this period of time where many people are asymptomatic, and most people recover almost with no symptoms. It's like for the ones that get this seriously, it's bad. But for many people, you're just going to get over it, and it's like a bad cold, or maybe it felt like a flu or whatever, right? But you staying away or not getting too close to people will prevent the spread of it. It's all about the preventing the spread of it. And basically, they're trying to prevent the spread of something that is not obviously there. Okay, so during, like, you know, January in Cape Breton, you know, lots of people are sick with the flu, and people know what the flu is all about and say, oh, you know, he's got the flu, she's got the flu, or whatever. So what do people do? Well, the people with the flu stay home, they should, and others kind of try to avoid being around situations where there's lots of flu going on. This thing is kind of different because of the asymptomatic possibility of the transmission. So if we can follow what health says, try to keep your distance a bit, and you know, that doesn't mean you're like walking down the street and you see someone, you run across the street, right? Or don't say hello to people you used to know or anything like that, right? You got to be. There's a balance between all this, but again, you're not going down to the local. Well, the Legion's closed yesterday, I believe, but you know, and sit around and talking with the folks there all night long, which is a great thing and people like to do. But for now, you have to stop that. And then one of the big notions you hear about is the flattening the curve notion, which means they don't want a giant spike of all the illnesses, of all the illnesses with the people that are seriously ill that need hospitalization. What you're doing is trying to flatten the curve of the people that could end up being hospitalized. So in other words, you may end up with the same number of them, but they don't all come at once. And to avoid them all coming at once, the theory now is if we can stay moderately apart from people, you know, all the while hand washing, do all that, you're out, you're touching stuff, come home, wash your hands, don't get your hands in your face or your fingers in your mouth somehow, don't do any of those things, then we can lessen this, right? That's the notion behind it all, and I have to take faith, and then this is going to help. It's going to work, and you know, we're a small population here. And for our Cape Breton or listeners, that's another thing. You know, we're not Toronto with, you know, a million people in that. We're a smaller place, so it's less people around anyway. And if we do the social distancing for a little while, Hopefully we can all get back to what we used to do, you know, sooner than later with a lot less people getting ill, and because nobody wants that.
Well, not that long ago, Dialogue had the pleasure of having a conversation with local artist Donnie Campbell after he was honored at the East Coast Music Awards in PEI. Now, the talented veteran musician has won another award, the Slate Music Unsung Hero from the Canadian Folk Music Awards. We were talking before we actually turned the microphones on, and I asked you if you knew what the Canadian Folk Music Award was.
No.
You had no idea.
I had no idea, no.
No. And so you were notified that you had won. It's called the Slate Music.
Yeah, I got an email on
Unsung
Christmas
Hero
Eve.
Award. On Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve, but I wasn't allowed to say anything. Yeah. So I thought that's pretty good.
You were proud of the fact that you won an award that you never heard of.
Never heard of, yeah.
The East Coast Music Awards last year. It seems like a lot longer than that, but they gave you the Stompin' Tom Award, which you were very humbled by, and so
I was.
This
is really humbled.
And this one says, now get this, what people say is an unsung hero. You're an icon. You're a Canadian icon.
That's what they said. I'm right up there with Lightfoot and the Dalai Lama.
And in every sense, well, I wouldn't go that far.
I just learned to read when I was in grade 3 or 4, you know, that's what.
In every sense of the word of Canadian icon, an unsung hero, there's Donnie Campbell's picture right alongside it. Humbling?
Something, eh?
Yeah. Humbling?
I guess. It sure is.
Where do you go from here?
I don't know, because I broke my finger and I got the Stompin' Tom Award. I had a stroke and I got the Canadian Folk Music Awards. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to know.
That's not good. That's not good news at all.
Yeah, I don't know. Where do you go? I mean, this is a nice Canadian. It's a national award. So
how long have you been playing music? When did you first start?
I guess the first trip to a stage was, well, when I was a kid in the Kiwanis Music Festivals with the school choirs and church choirs. But I guess I was 14 at Highland Village Day.
Do you remember what you played?
The guitar.
And what song? Do you remember what music?
Listen, I don't remember what I did this morning. You don't. Honestly, I don't, let alone what. That was, 66? I'll be 66 Friday. I was 14. That was, what's 14?
But you weren't always, did you always consider yourself a folk singer?
Yes.
No, did you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You tried other.
Oh, I still do. When Jinx and I play at Key Juice, we do everything from, you know, the Kingston Trio type of stuff, to the old rock and roll, to the modern day music, and a little bit of everything. I like any kind of music. One of my favorites is still the Mills Brothers and Dean Martin. Perry Como. We do Perry Como stuff when we're at, you know.
It's all music, right?
It's all music, yeah. Good music is good music.
Now, this is going to sound kind of corny, but a lot of musicians will say, listen, I play because I love music.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why Donnie Campbell does
it? Sure. Absolutely.
You didn't become rich playing music over the years?
No.
All of these awards you're getting lately.
I'm not telling you.
Oh, you probably wouldn't. All of these awards you've been getting lately don't have big monetary awards attached to them.
No, actually, most of them cost you money to go get them.
Well, that's what makes
it broke. I'd be broke if I had a... Anyway. But it's worth it.
Is that typical of Cape Breton musicians that usually they just want to play for the music? And
I think so.
Not
for the most part.
For the glory?
For the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, if we were there for the glory, well, it's the same as the radio. If I was there for the glory and the money, I'd have been gone 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, everybody would know, I would think, that's listening right now would know that you're the host of Celtic Serenade.
Mm-hmm.
How long that's been? How long? Over 40?
46 years.
46 years since you started that program?
Yeah.
Does that still go out to other parts of the world?
It's all over the world. I get emails all the time from Ireland, Scotland, Australia, England, throughout the States. I had one from the Poo Poo Islands in the South Pacific one night.
Where the heck is that?
I don't know. I can hardly find the South Pacific, let alone the Poo Poo Islands.
They're listening to Celtic Serenade.
Yeah, it's amazing. Do you remember? Well, you'd remember back in the day when we used to get those postcards from Scandinavia or wherever, and they'd say, picked you up on Skip.
Yep.
Remember them?
Yeah, they
pick
up.
It's, now it's
and
just
the atmospheric skip yeah. would pick the you pick,
pick up,
up
the show. Yeah, wouldn't we be the big shots then?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
that was your bragging rights. But now it's well, this station is heard all over the world, and they say they listen to the coast.
Yeah, how did when you started Celtic Serenade? You just said I'm going to sit down and play some Irish music.
I started. Well, Sheldon again is my cousin that started it, and he went away to school. So I was basically just playing like Cape Breton fiddle music, the Scottish and Irish groups that I had known because I had just come off the road from playing. And, you know, the John Allen and Charlie McKinnon, because there was nobody else back then. You know, we didn't have the music back then that we have today. So I was kind of like just staying with that type of music. And then Rosemary Hutchison, or she's McCormick now, she had the Gaelic show on CBI. And then, of course, Jack Pelly was doing the Newfoundland music. Dennis Kaiser playing bluegrass, so all the genres were covered. And as Jack went away and the Gaelic disappeared on CJC or on CBC for, you know, Island Echoes and those type of shows, I started adding more of that music into it and the bluegrass and stuff, and it's just evolved into that now. And it's more than Celtic music now. It's I think it's, I try to make it music that I like and a good variety of music. If you want good variety, I think of folk music, this is where to come.
Well, it must be working. That's why the show has been on for 46
yeah,
years.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's amazing to me how, after 46 years, how it's still a popular show and it's still relevant. People still come up to me and say that they listen.
We talked about this before, but I'll ask you again because, you know, you keep getting these awards, so I have to keep interviewing you. And
it sounds like it's such a chore for
no,
you.
No, no. Of course you know I'm joking. But today's music compared to when you started out, and first of all, give me some of your mentors and that. Who did you look up to when you started playing?
Charlie McKinnon. I can remember. Well, he worked with my father at the plant, so I got to know him since I was a kid. And I can remember being a little kid, you know, going pick up my father's check. Well, I didn't pick it up. I just went with my father to pick it up.
At the steel plant.
At the steel plant.
Yeah.
And they worked on the railroad, and they took me on the train through the steel plant. And I remember sitting in Charlie McKinnon's lap and blowing the horn, you know. So then, of course, John Allen. I remember Archie Thomas was a singer, still sings. And they were kind of your heroes. You
Charlie
know?
McKinnon and those guys, they sang the old Cape Breton songs.
The old Cape Breton songs. And then there was the Clancy Brothers, of course. And, you know, and my mother was singing all the time. When she wasn't growling at me, and but you know, we would watch Don Messer, would watch
everything was music,
everything, you know, Ed Sullivan, you know. Yeah. So I learned at an early age to like every kind of music.
And what did you? But you took mostly to the folk music part of it, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
But you played in bands. You played in bands.
I played in bands, yeah. And we did the folk music.
Miller's Jug.
We did the Irish and folk music,
which was a popular band back in the day. Yeah, it really was. That was in the '70s.
That was in the '70s. There was us, Ryan's Fancy, and the Rovers.
Yeah,
and they were on the other side. Well, the Sons of Erin, they were on the other side as to out in Vancouver. But.
So when you played with that type of band, you played in every bar, in every pub. In every province in Canada.
From the Strand in St. John's, Newfoundland, to the Blarney Stone in Vancouver, BC.
Good times?
Mostly, yeah. Yeah, a lot of good stories.
Hard work?
It is.
Late hours?
It's hard work. Like people, and all they see is like the couple of hours that you're on stage. You know, you're traveling, you're trying to get some sleep, you're trying to do sound checks, it's more than the 2 hours.
What's changed between then and now? Is it the same today? If you're starting out in a local or a local group in Cape Breton, let's say, are you still doing the same thing, trying to get your music heard? Are you still?
It's a lot tougher now because I don't think that there's the places to play and that are willing to pay as there was when we were young. We were making a lot more money back in the 70s. Than they are now. We don't have the population either to support the clubs and the bars, and it's just a whole different world. It's a different game.
It's technically a whole different world too, though.
Oh,
right?
Technically, you know, I can remember Donnie Brown saying back, you know, 40 years ago, you know, how come your show is so popular? What makes it popular? And I said, well, I'm playing music they want to hear.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, why do people go to Wyona for Highland Village Day? And why do people go in the thousands to Big Pond or to Broad Cove? It's to hear the music. We didn't have it back then. Now we have CD players and everywhere, cassette players everywhere. The music is everywhere. So people don't have to go out and see it anymore.
But there's something to be said, right, for sitting down and listening to something and being there live and listening to a band perform it. And there's something to be said about the atmosphere and everything else, but also about the music. If I listen to a band or a group or whatever the case may be, and I hear something on stage that's not the same as the record or the whatever I just heard, I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
But if I listen to you...
Oh, you can't. You know, most people can't go and reproduce on stage what you've... you have on a record.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to say, is that the hardest part to...
To replicate?
Well, not only replicate, but do that kind of production live.
Well, you can't do it live. Yeah. Because you can't afford to do it live. You can't afford the 4 and 5 and 6-piece bands.
That would be required.
That would be required, you know? So like when Jinx and I play, it's a guitar and a bass.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to compete with a recording with, you know.
But it's still entertainment. It's all entertainment.
It's all entertainment.
Do you think you've changed personally the way that you play now from the way that when you first started? Of course, you'd be more experienced, of course, but has your playing changed in any way?
Yeah, a whole lot.
How so?
I don't care if I forget the words anymore. You know, I don't care there's times and places we do, and I'll say that Wednesday nights at Kiju's restaurant where we play. If you want to hear us start together, end together, and know the words, this is not necessarily the place. You know,
it's going to happen.
Go to the Savoy. Go to the Cone. Here we want it. Just treat it like we're in your living room. I've been there. I've done it.
Yeah.
You know, like now we just treat it as if we're in your living room or you're in our living room. If you have a request, we'll do it.
Yeah.
We may know one line of the chorus and do la, 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 la.
So when Donnie Campbell goes to somebody's home, say it's invited over, and it's come on over and, you know, we're having a few people over tonight, do you take your guitar? You know you're going to be asked to play.
Yeah, yeah, usually. Yeah.
And do you play all the time?
Most times.
Yeah. Most times.
Yeah.
Because you'd be asked. That's not that's why they're asking you, but you would be expected to do that sort of thing.
And why not?
Yeah, okay. Good answer.
Why not?
Good answer.
I mean, if somebody's willing to come and see you, or it's when they start forgetting me, that's when I'll worry.
I'll share a story of mine. Uh-huh. I once saw Stomp and Tom, whose award you received last year in honor of Stomp and Tom. I once saw him play at the Savoy Theater, and he was on stage, and suddenly during one of his songs, he just stopped, and he just said, "I forgot the expletive song words," and he just started again, and the audience loved it.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you're real. It's just showing that we're human like everybody else.
And
I'm getting old.
And he had something a clear liquid in a glass that he was sipping on every
water.
Now and then. I think it was water. I don't know what you musicians do, but have you ever been in a situation in a bar where you said, oh, we got to get out of here because things are getting kind of boisterous or whatever? Did you ever find yourself in that sort of situation over the years?
Oh, yeah, especially back in the days when we'd be doing the beer bashes at the universities. Some of them got...
You're not going to share any of those stories, are you?
Oh, no, not here, no. Some of them got pretty wild, you know? Lots of fights.
Yeah.
I can remember one time, I thought... It was a club in Sydney. It was on Charlotte Street upstairs. And I remember a fight broke out. And John Ferguson's grandmother was still alive. And his grandmother and his parents were in the audience. And I'm sure she was in her 70s or 80s at that point, got up and started hitting the guy with the purse. And playing with strippers. And, you know, and just people would say the wrong things to them. And
Okay, you don't want to get...
Lots of good times.
Anything that stands out in particular, Jordan? I mean, I hate asking that question because you've had such a long career. But would anything stand out in your career that say, listen, this is the time that I thought I finally made it?
I've never thought I made it. I never looked to make it. Honest, and that's honest. I just always figured if it happens, it happens.
That's why you're getting Unsung Hero Awards.
But there are two nights that stick out. One was the first time I worked with Huey and Allen.
There you go.
And another was when it was the International Gathering of the Girl Guides out in the Myra, and John Allen and I did the song for the Myra, and we just traded verses, and you know, we had the Men of the Deeps as a background chorus.
Wow.
Sister Rita Claire's choir was there, Donnie Palmer on the flute, Winnie Chafe on the fiddle, you know, things like that. You know.
There's two
things that really stand out.
You quite know. The historic lineup there. Yeah. Of Cape Breton entertainers.
And the Rovers. And when the Rovers asked me to go up on stage with them, and I'm like, hey, I'm no rocket scientist, but I'm not missing this chance. there's lots of things. And
unfortunate,
I'm no better than anybody else.
Unfortunate now, though, that when a person like yourself does receive an award and they set it all up and the awards were supposed to be held in PEI, but yeah. Because of the coronavirus situation... A little bit disappointing.
Yeah, of course. Because I wanted to go see. I mean, there's people that I haven't seen in years, you know, and you'd like to see them again. But hey, that's life, you know. What's that song? From Hee Haw.
That's life.
I went to. I got the award, and it was gone. But no, it's in all seriousness. I mean, we're in some pretty weird times, and I think they made the right decision.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they'll hold it again or whatever.
Well, they're saying that they're going to find another way of doing it.
Yeah,
you know, I'm more disappointed. I'm more disappointed in the Eagles not getting to the playoffs.
Yeah, but they finished in what place?
Third,
because of the standings.
Yeah.
Listen, the thing about you, and let me say this personally, is that when I call you up, look for the interview. You kind of shy away from it. What do you want to interview me for? You already interviewed me a year ago. Well, it's a different award this time.
Yeah.
But you don't, I know you don't like the publicity of it. You don't like the big flashy lights. It's not Donnie Campbell.
Nice. It's nice to get it, but okay, I got it. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on.
So now you just continue doing what you continue doing. You keep playing music.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, health is okay.
Health is fine.
Good.
So far. Yeah.
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 So you'll be probably getting another award in the next year or so. Do you know of any out there?
I don't know. What do I have to get to get? What do I, you know, I have to break a finger or have a stroke?
I'm not sure.
I'm lucky, Dave. I mean, look.
I don't know what comes after.
I broke a finger, and I was lucky enough that I was able to continue playing with two fingers in an open tuning. I had a stroke. That could have been so much worse. You know, I could be paralyzed. I could be dead. I've... Knock on wood, I'm lucky.
Yeah. As I said, I don't know what comes after Icon. Yeah. I think
no, I don't know.
I thought that was the top when you become an Icon.
Icon, yeah.
A lot of icons aren't around anymore, okay? Let me put it that way. But if you're talking to me and I'm calling you an icon, that's a pretty good thing.
I'd like to know who wrote it.
It doesn't matter. Just appreciate it.
Yeah, oh, I do. Seriously, I do. It's quite an honor to get a national award.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's great. We'll look forward to the next one.
Yeah.
And we look forward to hearing you all the time anyway, wherever you go.
Yeah.
He doesn't carry a guitar strapped to his back, by the way.
No.
If you asked him to play a guitar right now, I don't think there'd be one in your vehicle, would there?
No.
you had to think about that for a minute. Thanks for coming
by. Yeah, I can't remember if I took it out or not. That's...
Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. As usual, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.